No, this is what I say officially and unofficially. Yeah, this is what I say officially and unofficially. I mean, curiosity is fine, but you still have to, if you're going to use taxpayers' money, you have to, you know, poets are as curious as we are. And I see absolutely no reason why you should get money because we are curious, and philosophers and poets should not. So so it's curiosity is good, but it's
not to get money.
No, because I'm connecting it. It's something taxpayers should be interested in. So I should receive money. and I do. And I do. and I do. Okay. So you know, the point is actually, it's not a facetious point. Point is there's a lot of interest in spintronics for a reason. And the reason is that in semiconductors, you can control charge transport by applying electric field from outside. Okay, and it's not something you can do in metals. And the reason you cannot is metals just have too high an electron density. So transistors are not made of metals. All the electrons move around very fast in metals. You cannot control them from outside. So the idea was that if you can make semiconductors ferromagnetic, or more precisely, if you can control spin polarization in semiconductors so that you can have spin polarized current, then you are adding functionalities. So far, almost all of modern microelectronics is based on, you know, transistors, and now optics have come in, of course. So you have, is there a pointer here? Yeah. So you have photons and charges being controlled in semiconductor. That's your optoelectronics. And the magnetism was separate. Magnetism is also a very important part, as you know, of modern microelectronics. Your hard storage is done all on magnetics, but it's separate. That's why when you turn a computer on, booting up takes time. Booting up takes time because storage is somewhere else. If you can make semiconductors ferromagnetic, then at least in principle, you can think of doing all three together. We are nowhere near there. But if you can do all three together, then, you know, all these words like multifunctionalities and so on start making sense. And the first step there is, if you can make semiconductors ferromagnetic, then in principle, at least, you have spin polarization and charge control both on the same device, and at least you could go somewhere. We are very far from there, but this material science, trying to make semiconductors ferromagnetic, is where it begins in some sense.
Have we had ferromagnetic semiconductors for 50 years?
We had, but those are very bad semiconductors. Those are not used in, those are called semiconductors only because people like calling them. Europium oxide is a semiconductor only for people who work on europium oxide. It's not a semiconductor for semiconductor industry. No device has ever been made of europium oxide, and unlikely it will ever be made of europium oxide, okay? So how do you make a semiconductor ferromagnetic? As Dan just said, it doesn't quite apply to europium oxide, but it's known. Maybe not 50 years, but for a very long time. You want to dope it with magnetic ions. I'm actually going to give you the history of the subject where we will not go back 50 years, but we'll go back 40 years. And so, for example, you take something like gallium arsenide, and you put manganese in it, typically 1 to 10%, and manganese, you hope, goes substitutionally into gallium sites. That happens, at least to some degree. I'll come back to this point. Now, putting manganese in gallium arsenide is very difficult. So the idea has been around for a very long time, but people actually have been able to do it only in the recent past. Mainly one individual, Hideo Ono, in Japan, has been working on it for 15 years or so and succeeded. Because manganese doesn't dissolve in gallium arsenide. So you have to do all kinds of tricks, low temperature MB and so on, to make manganese go in. What it wants to do is that it wants to form manganese arsenide precipitate. So you have a mixture of gallium arsenide and manganese arsenide, which is not good. But I think the main impetus from spintronics came when in 1996, 1997, Hideo Ono at Tohoku University in Japan actually made an intrinsic ferromagnetic semiconductor. These things are also called diluted magnetic semiconductors because, you know, diluting things and you have very low hole concentration. Now, what manganese does here, manganese does many things, but the two main things it does is that it provides a local moment. It provides local moment, so, you know, S5 half, manganese ion sitting, but it also acts as acceptors. It provides you holes. Okay, I'll talk about holes because that's what happens in gallium manganese arsenide. But as you'll see for much of the talk, the fact that it's holes or electrons will not make much of a difference. And I should point out, one of the problems one has right now with ferromagnetic semiconductors is almost all the ones, not almost all the ones that have been made so far are hole ferromagnetic semiconductors. I'm going to give you a list. All of them are holes. No good. Holes are not useful for many things because you need, if you are going to have transistor action, you need what is called bipolar. You need electrons and holes both. No transistor is made just, you know, there is a unipolar transistor. And if we are stuck with just whole ferromagnetic semiconductors, you're not going to go very far. That's just an aside. I would not have much to say on that point. But in any case, for our purpose, these are carriers. Electrons are holes. So
is it also important that if it's ferromagnetic at room temperature?
Yeah.
Is that true for this system?
No. I'll come to that. Yeah. Of course it's important ferromagnetic at room temperature. So the whole push here is trying to understand the mechanism so can push the TC to room temperature. For this, it's 110 Kelvin at this stage. That's what has been achieved. But there are claims of others which are room temperature. I'll come to that in a second. So the basic idea is that you put manganese. Manganese is actually kind of a deep level. It's 100-150 MeV above the valence band. And so this is my cartoon of the manganese ions sitting in some cation sites, gallium sites. It produces some holes. And it turns out that the hole density, NH, is much, much less than the manganese density. Although you'd expect, you know, manganese, which becomes plus plus, would produce one hole per manganese ion, so you'd expect this number to be equal. In reality, experimentally, it's known that this number is much, much less. N hole is much, much less than N manganese. This will turn out to be a very important point of physics, that N hole is much, much less than N manganese. Typical ratio is 10. So this density is about factor of 10 larger than that. In semiconductor physics language, this is called a compensated semiconductor. This is quite common in semiconductors, that you have other defects which are producing electrons or holes are getting absorbed. Exactly the details of why this is so is still not understood and is very actively being discussed, debated, and studied. I'm going to come back to that. There are two known kinds of defects which could cause this. One is arsenic antisite, arsenic sitting in gallium site, which turns out to be very common when you have this low temperature MBE. The other possibility is that manganese, instead of going substitutional into gallium, is going as an interstitial. If manganese goes as interstitial, it turns out it then is a donor, gives rise to two electrons. So suppose a certain fraction of manganese is sitting as interstitial, each of them producing two electrons, manganese which are substitutional at gallium site producing one hole, so you'll have some compensation. But for our purpose, the important thing is that this strong inequality holds, okay? Because of defects, localization, also. The minimal model for this, and I think minimal model, people now believe that minimal model to be generally true. And most of the theorists who are working on it, who are doing effective theory of the problem, are working with the minimal model. Of course, we have to do band structure calculations, and large amount of that is going on also. Nicola Hill here is doing that. She has been one of the pioneers. And I'd say that overall, although there is not total unanimity, but band structure theories, at least the ones I like, the ones I think are good, are bearing out that this minimal model is good, okay? But it's not totally agreed. There certainly are band structure theories which says that no, ferromagnetism here has not much to do with mediation by carriers. It just happens. And so I will make some comments on band structure, but I will not. These are ab initio band structure, LDA type theories, and so the model that I'll talk about is just a local coupling between the manganese S spin 5 half, which will be treated classically, large spin, with the hole, which I will take to be spin half, but in real gallium arsenide it's not spin half, it's spin 3 half because there is very strong spin orbit coupling in gallium arsenide. Yeah.
Should I just think about these holes as also D bands, which are just
the most? That's a good question. Where the holes are is another matter of controversy. So people who like doing just simple mean field theory, and then start from there and do theory like put in spin waves and so on, will say these are just the valence band holes, okay? Just the holes in the valence band, so of gallium arsenide, okay? The other possibility, the holes could be in the impurity band, that this forms impurity band, and I'm going to show you theories based on both. Clearly, it's neither extreme picture is correct, as you'll see, okay, in a minute, okay? But the important point is that, I mean, your question already alludes to that, is there should be some relationship between magnetism and transport here. That will give us an indication, and you'll see that the whole subject here theoretically and experimentally has been correlating magnetism and transport because you're talking about carrier-mediated ferromagnetism, and there should be a correlation. Normally, you don't think of ferromagnets as subjects where transport gives you much information about magnetism. You know, there's some detailed information, but here they go hand in hand because of this reason.
But there's no like a polarization or this kind of
thing. No, there are those experiments also. I mean, I would say the experiments clearly show impurity bands are playing a very strong role. Alan McDonald will tell you experiments are clearly showing that it's all valence band. So, you know, it's a little bit like high TC, but let's hope it's not that bad.
Is it possible to make deliberate compensation or change compensation level?
It certainly is, and I'm going to come to that. It has not been done in a grid control where people have done annealing. That's coming next, yes. But one still doesn't know the whole story. This subject is very new, less than a year, those aspects, okay?
Because then you could really check whether...
Absolutely. So if you take this to be the paradigm, which is a local, really Kondo-type coupling, but very far from Kondo regime, that you have holes coupled to spin, this coupling turns out to be anti-ferromagnetic for holes, but it really doesn't matter what this coupling is. You'll still get global ferromagnetism. And if you assume J to be small, much, much smaller than the basic band parameter T, then you can immediately do a perturbation theory, which in this case is the same as the mean field theory for these itinerant holes, that this was first done 60 years ago by Bloch and Nabarro in the context of really ferromagnetism of iron and nickel. It turns out there it doesn't quite apply, because all you'll conclude that from a coupling like this, if you do perturbation theory just on dimensional ground, you'll coupling the TC will go as spin splitting squared divided by EF, and in iron and nickel, this number is microkelvin. So, you know, their original idea was that maybe in iron and nickel, the nuclei are aligning because of the carriers being polarized. That's a very nice idea. And later on, of course, you know, this was done in a much bigger way by Zener. And it was dropped as a theory of ferromagnetism because the numbers made no sense. Fermi energy is too large in these systems and the coupling is too weak. But here is a system where Fermi energy is low and coupling is large. So this exactly same mechanism could give you a mean field TC, which is of the order of hundreds of kelvins if you put these numbers in. So what you have is J, this coupling, which someone like Nicola can calculate, is of the order of electron volt in subunit, X, the manganese concentration. And then for this particular model, you get a density to the power 1/3 coming because of the way the susceptibility varies in three dimensions, okay? And the claim is that this is not bad as a zeroth order theory. I'll have much more to say about this point. So let me just try to connect it with something that people know. This is a very ugly, busy transparency, but I'm going to spend a few minutes on it, okay? It just kept on becoming, let me just try to focus your attention on the picture, okay? So what I have tried doing here, not very successfully, I'm afraid, is this is the hole density, and this is the manganese density. Okay, and we'll assume that they are independently controllable, which may or may not be true. You'll see that it's not that untrue. And what we want to say is that we want to draw a phase diagram, let's say T is equal to zero, phase diagram as a function of this. Now, all of you are familiar with some aspects of this phase diagram. If I go all the way up here, all the way up, that's the Kondo regime, you know, very high Fermi surface, a metallic system with some small local moments. We are very far from the Kondo regime. It's the same Hamiltonian, but Kondo physics will play no role. If I go all the way up here, where you have approximately, again, very, very high impedance density, a very, very high hole density, you know, a metallic Fermi surface, but magnetic moment density is also high, then we call that Kondo lattice. And of course, much work has been done on that. Usually, when an intermediate, if you include disorder and so on, you have ferromagnetic alloys, magnetic glasses, all those things. All those things are up there somewhere. This has been a huge subject in condensed matter physics for the last 40 years. But normally, we don't think of this regime where you have much more magnetic moment than the hole density. You see, over here, other than some singularities, which are, of course, of great interest to us, the magnetic moment over here, the magnetic moments are small perturbation to the Fermi surface. The Fermi surface is not destroyed by the magnetic moment. When you come down here, the concept of Fermi surface may not be that relevant anymore because you have many more local moments than hole density. So the whole ferromagnetic semiconductor game is being played below the line, way below the line where hole density is equal to local moment density. So it's actually even below some line where, let's say, this number, the ratio NH over NI, is 1/10, okay, over here somewhere. And what is found experimentally, there is a regime here, okay, there is a regime here where the system is ferromagnetic. Exactly how large this regime is a matter of controversy. Not controversy, it's an evolving subject, as you'll see in the experimental transparency I'll show you. See, Antoine asked me to give you a perspective, and so I'm giving you some of the background, okay, instead of just going into the theory. So how large is this regime is still a matter of, not really controversy, a matter of evolution. People are still studying it, but this definitely regime here, perhaps from 1% manganese to something like 10% manganese when you have a ferromagnet, and it seems ferromagnetism disappears somewhere here, in some cases even here, I'll show you. And there is something else that's very interesting. It comes back to what Chimia, you are asking, is that it seems that the system is insulating for low manganese concentration. It's metallic for some intermediate manganese concentration where TC is also highest. And then it goes insulating again at larger manganese concentration. Now, whether it really goes insulating here or not is being debated now. It seems in some experiments it does, but if you optimize all your parameters, optimize compensation, anneal the sample, you know, get rid of your defects, then perhaps it doesn't come down. Perhaps it goes on like this somewhere. This is, again, you know, getting phase diagram like this through experiment is an evolving thing. Okay? So this is the phase diagram you have to keep in mind. The phase diagram has not been completed at all. I mean, remember in high TC, you know, in spite of what? High TC has a couple of 100,000 papers altogether. And the phase diagram is now more or less well established, but people still debate, you know, exactly what is there in between the antiferromagnetic phase and the superconducting phase along that line. So this is going to take some time, because in this subject, I would say in the last 3 years, maybe there have been 100 theory papers, no more than that. All the pace is going up, okay?
Sander?
Yeah.
Just one remark.
Please.
And this regime is not totally unknown to the condo lattice aficionados.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, it seems to me this is very similar to the regime that Nozier drew attention to many years ago, the exhaustion regime, in which
that's
very few carriers that have magnetic impurities.
That is certainly true, but
and there have been several studies of ferromagnetism regime.
But the most of the really powerful theoretical studies are limited to low dimensions because you can make exact statement. I mean that I actually looked at the literature and I missed something. I would like to talk about it. I may very well have missed something, but somehow those studies seem to be having no effect on the current, you know, people rediscover things. So I should certainly talk to you. Okay.
No, pointed out something different.
Yeah, that paper I know, but there he was not talking about ferromagnetism. That paper I'm familiar with.
There can be many other different magnetic orders.
Right, exactly.
The point was made very early.
Right.
When we get around those,
in fact, that's one of the issues I'm very interested in.
There's been some studies showing ferromagnetism in that regime.
That, in fact, is one of the issues I'm very interested in, that you know, for technological purposes, we want it to be a room temperature ferromagnet. But what I'm personally interested in is, what are the other possible phases there? And you'll see there's so many interactions that are bound to be other possible phases, and that's what we want to understand, okay? Now, what has also been claimed is that if you are in this optimum regime, okay, if you're in this optimum regime, and then you can somehow raise the whole density, okay, the claim is, you saw in mean field theory, the claim would be that in this regime, this regime is the regime where the mean field picture that I gave you, this RKKY Zenoth type theory applies, which in this context was really rediscovered by Diddle and Alan MacDonald. In this regime, if you just keep on increasing hole density, then the ferromagnetic TC should keep on going up as n to the power 1/3 forever. And the question that, you know, I have, and my collaborators, Andy Millis and others have, is that really true, or are there other phases that are there limits on TC, because there are other phases that these theories are not considering? I mean, we believe there are, and that's one of the theoretical issues where experiment has not made much contribution yet, but I think they will. Now, to really make your life complicated, let me just tell you that these are, of course, only two of the axes. In real system, there are many, many, it's a multi-dimensional phase space. It's a truly multi-dimensional phase space. And let me just mention to you the ones that we already know are important. And there may be others that we don't know of. The ones that you already know of important. Absolutely band structure, which I call spin orbit coupling, that's just, I could not write band, okay? That's very important. And in particular, this is valence band hole, so spin orbit coupling is known to be very important. So band structure is very important here. You know, the valence band size, this is just a dimension quantity, T valence band width. Of course, the strength of the coupling between the holes and mangan is important. But something I didn't mention, but the obvious, the manganese ions themselves couple also. They couple antiferromagnetically. The coupling, direct exchange coupling between two manganese ions is antiferromagnetic. That is not here anywhere in the theory. That will have an effect. That will introduce some frustration. And that's being totally left out of the theory on the basis that it's dilute, they're very far apart, they don't matter. That clearly is not going to be true as you start going in this direction. It's clearly not true when you start throwing in disorder, because when you have disorder, there'll be manganese clusters somewhere. So disorder is the other thing that's a total unknown. And it's clear that you have many different kinds of disorder here. You have arsenic anthracite at gallium sites. You have manganese interstitials. You have regular disorder, random disorder, and other things that you may not know of. So, you know, the total problem is extremely rich, and the possibilities are huge. Mostly we are thinking of these two parameters and then cranking up J, and then spin orbit coupling has been included by several workers, but the total situation is really not known. Let me also throw in here, while we are at this phase diagram, that manganites and the hexaboride materials also fall somewhere in this phase diagram. Manganites are basically in the limit where J is much, much larger than T, and the density is high. So J much, much larger than T limit is, of course, different from J much, much less than T, or J comparable to T, which is what ferromagnetic semiconductors are. Hexaborides are a problem. I believe that they belong to this phase diagram also. But I don't know what the local moments are, okay? You know, I mean, only way I can say local moments there, if there are impurities there that nobody knows of. But Zach Fisk is a very careful, smart guy, so I don't want to say that there are some local moments there that he doesn't know of. But hexaborides, when you look at the phenomenology, they are so much like these diluted magnetic semiconductor systems that, you don't agree, Vladimir, that they're I'm talking about phenomenology. That's what Zach told me.
The calcium hexaboride done by Melanchthon, that was a different story because that didn't have definitely a lot of moments.
Right.
But as it turns out, very recently, mass spectroscopy shows that the only reason why it was a ferromagnetic is because of the iron impurities.
Okay, so that's what I told Zach Fisk 2 years ago. And Zach absolutely swore up and down there are no impurities there. I said, well, if there are impurities there, then it's just like these materials. It's no difference at all. He said, well, you know, it looks just like that. Have you thought about excitons and so on? I said, there's no exciton here. Are you sure you don't have, well, I said nickel, cobalt, iron, or manganese. He said, oh, I'm absolutely sure. Okay, all right, so hexaboroids are just exactly the same thing.
The two-dimensionality is very important, right? Because in this formula, then if you are three-dimensional, then the F would increase with the...
No. There is a N here also because of the number of carriers. This is per carrier, this number.
So in your view, also the three-dimensional material should have the same kind of behavior?
That's correct. Yeah, that's why, this goes as n to the power 2/3. I put n to the power 2/3, this goes as n, so the whole thing goes as n to the power 1/3.
Right, but it would be much better to have it two-dimensional.
I agree. That thought has already been proposed.
Okay.
Because, yeah.
And just to make sure I understand this mechanism, basically what you say is that in this case we can integrate out the conduction electrons.
That's correct.
And then we have some JIJ.
Some effective model, right.
And the strength of the JIJs is this Kondo coupling square.
That's correct. So, So you have some.
Build on that.
Correct. Absolutely. And the reason I'm not calling it RKKY, this is normally called RKKY, is that the word RKKY is completely stupid here. This thing, the length scales are such that you are only seeing the first oscillation. You never see your wave, the length scale, your KF is so small. Calling it RKKY, it is RKKY.
Yeah.
But this was done by Bloch and Nobaro, 12 years before RKKY. Yeah. Okay, so.
And that's why it's ferromagnetic.
Absolutely. You have never see these oscillations. You are here. You know, you're just seeing the first one, okay?
Right.
So it's very important that KF is extremely small. Okay, that's very important. Because otherwise you'll have frustration. Otherwise it'll be like an RKKY spin glass. So you see, little bit of this thing everybody knows, but this is in a regime that we really normally do not work on because materials did not exist before.
But also you worry that for this to be valid, right, the electron has to be completely localized.
Let's come to that. This is going to be a main topic, connecting. Yeah, let's come to that. But so the thing is that I wanted to connect you to things that you know, and I think that's happening. That's very important to understand what regime. I mean, whenever I give this talk in a general group, I don't make these things clear, but upon ask me to make these things clear, people get confused because you know about this model, but the regime what it is, you have not thought much about it. That's the point I'm trying to make. Okay? So this is then just saying what I said. So local Kondo RKKY is then they all become the same thing in this limit, okay, in this main field limit. And Kondo physics you're ignoring. I already told you, maybe at some extremely small crossover temperature that may be important. So let me now show you the original experiment of Ido Ono, really a seminal experiment. It's one of those things that's been trying 10 years to make this happen and made this happen, which made this possible. So here is the transport data. Sheet resistivity as a function of temperature. And here is the same sample corresponding TC measured by measuring magnetization directly. So what you now find, this is the original 1996 applied physics letters, and these data, you'll see that there have been some changes in our conclusion. So let's just go through it slowly. X is the manganese concentration. As you see, it's non-monotonic in X. If you have very small value of X, only 1%, the system is insulating. Okay? And TC is very low. As you increase X, it's still insulating. TC is going up, it's slightly less insulating, if you like. Then at some point, around 3%, you know, 3.5% there, it becomes metallic, very bad metal. Look at the values of sheet resistivity, it's very large. If you convert them into resistivity, it's of the order of ohm centimeter. So it's, you know, 9 orders of magnitude larger than copper. But if you define a metal as something which has finite resistivity at zero temperature, it looks like it's a metal. But in any case, TC now starts going up. The best metallic sample that they have here is at 5.3%. That's what TC is highest. That comes back to your point. And TC has not gone much up. It's around 120 Kelvin still. So there is a recent claim from Tom Foxon that he has increased it to 150. But you know, for this purpose, they're all the same. And then look what happens. As you increase X even larger, TC actually comes down. And after this, actually, TC goes to zero. And the system has become insulating again. So this was the re-entrant transition I was talking about. Insulator. Metal, this metal should be in quote unquote insulator again.
So resistivity maximum does not coincide with TC, or is that?
Which one?
Here on your plot. You have a resistivity maximum.
No, resistivity maximum has a 1-to-1 correlation with TC, but it's not identical. So in that sense, it's not that different from many other materials where there is a TP. Okay. Usually the resistivity maximum is slightly below the actual TC. Okay, but there is, in all the data, there is a correlation. Okay, so as Igor just pointed out, there is a maximum resistivity. This is, of course, genetic feature of many of these low-density ferromagnets, including manganites, that the ferromagnetic transition temperature, this is very different from, you know, the usual Fischer-Langer behavior, where you just see critical scattering, and really you have to take derivatives and so on to see anything, because like a specific heat anomaly. And normally, if you just take the standard theory of critical phenomena, then resistivity should not show. There were a lot of mistakes. Even Greg Dejean made a mistake on this thing in a paper. But later on, it was pointed out that all the resistivity should only show specific heat kind of fluctuations. But in these materials, because they're very low density, and this happens in manganites also, you have, in some cases, very pronounced peak, provided the material is, you can see, even in the insulating material, if you take a derivative, you'll see something. But this is in many materials. There's nothing special about this. Let me show you some. Manganites are the most well-known examples. Ferromagnetic TC varies from 30 to 110 Kelvin, depending on, you know, where you are here. And as you see, manganese concentration. And the explanation for this was that the hole density is different in each of these cases. Explanation was that the fact TC is changing, the fact that the system is going from an insulator to a metal back to an insulator is not because of X, but the hole density is highest around here, and then it goes down. Maybe to zero here, it goes down over here and here. That's what is going on. That's the generic feeling for people. Now, I already told you that that's old story. Here is a very recent, this is the same data as what I just showed you. This is gallium manganese arsenide of Ono from 1996-97. Here is data from earlier in the year, 2002, from a science article from the NRL group, Barry Yonker, a different material, germanium manganese, which is also ferromagnetic with about 100 Kelvin ferromagnetic transition temperature. Here the system is always insulating. He has seen no behavior which is can be called metallic, meaning he never sees this thing turn over. Okay, it's and all of these, this is not insulating, but all of, even here, the really bad insulators, those where the resistivity is diverging very fast, do not show magnetic behavior, but the rest does. And the transition temperature is of the order of 100 Kelvin. So one thing the theory needs to understand is both metallic, nominally metallic and nominally insulating DMS materials, dielectric magnetic semiconductor materials, are ferromagnetic, and theory should take into account that fact. And it cannot be just you have a theory which, so it cannot be just valence band holes only. If it's valence band holes only, then you have to somehow account for their localization, because if it's just free valence band hole, then there would not be insulating behavior. Here, very recent data, this year, 2001 and 2002, from the Penn State group, Peter Schiffer's group, where what they do is they grow a sample. This is magnetization as a function of temperature, and then anneal it. So this is, goes back to the question you are asking. By annealing, they are doing things to compensation. They don't exactly know what, but what they do at the same time, they measure, quote unquote, measure hole density. This measurement is very tricky, because how do you normally measure carrier density in a semiconductor? You measure carrier density in a semiconductor by doing hole measurements. But hole measurements in ferromagnets are notoriously difficult because you have something called anomalous hole effect. You already have a magnetic field, effective magnetic field due to magnetism. And so you extracting carrier density by doing hole measurements in ferromagnet is more of an art than a science. You need to know what the scattering mechanism is. The whole book's dedicated to this subject, okay? And you need to know whether it's true scattering or some other scattering. It's very complicated stuff. But people do some empirical things, and doing that they conclude that as they anneal, this annealing thing is also non-monotonic. Let me just go through it a little bit. So as grown sample just comes out of the, it's very non-mean field-like aim as a function of T, see? It doesn't look like a Brillouin function at all. Straight, kink, straight again. Then they anneal it for 2 hours, okay? It goes all the way up here, TC goes up from something like 70 Kelvin to 110 Kelvin, and the behavior looks very, very standard, quote-unquote, mean field. We know it's not mean field over here, but you know what I mean by mean field like. Then if they anneal longer, let's say they anneal for 24 hours, it becomes very bad. TC has gone way down. So clearly, annealing is not doing something simple. Annealing is doing competing things. Maybe there are many different kinds of defects, some of which are improving with annealing, some of which are going down with annealing. But they claim also that their measurement of hole density actually correlates with this. So the hole density is highest in this 2-hour anneal sample. See, this is the 2-hour anneal sample, okay? And the hole density is the lowest in this 24-hour anneal sample. So they're saying since the hole density is highest here, hole density is lowest here, they expect this to have higher TC than this to have lower TC based on this argument that we are discussing.
What temperature
is the measurement?
What temperature is the whole measurement
done? All of them are done, this temperature, these are all, I think, believe, room temperature. Yeah, but not, sorry, take back. They're all done below TC, of course, because to correlate with that. So
I'm talking about the whole measurement.
Yeah, whole measurement is below TC, because otherwise it will not make no sense. It's below TC.
Because in another article, he claims that all whole measurements were done at room temperature.
That's correct. Oh, that was Ono. Yeah. But Peter Schiffer has a dilution fridge and so on, so he did it at lower temperature. What I've asked him to do it at very low temperature systematically, that he did not do. He's doing it, it's in the paper, I just don't remember the number. I believe it's somewhere here. Okay, it's. I think it's at liquid helium temperature. That's what I think, but not, you know, millikelvin. Yes.
This magnetization plot, if you translate it into Bohr magnetons per manganese.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so the question is, let me put the question differently, is that whether the magnetization here is saturated or not. It turns out, as you can see, it obviously can't be saturated for all of them. What they claim is this one is almost saturated. I do not completely believe them. Yeah, I do not completely believe them. I think in many of these cases, it's not saturated. They have to apply an external magnetic field to saturate. That's the other controversy. If you talk to two different people, experimentalists, one of them would say, yes, we get saturated magnetization. The other one would say, we never get saturated magnetization. We have 80% of spins missing, and so on and so forth. Okay.
What's MFH? Higher field.
That's right. Higher field, they all saturate things. By applying fields, yes. They can saturate things by applying fields. That's, you know, that's the obvious thing. Even the ones who claim their aim of T is not saturated at the lowest temperature tell me that, yes, when they apply field, it's saturated.
Okay.
This is a few Tesla is what they would say. They're very, I mean, they don't put these things in the papers.
Enough, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And the J that you asked, I mean, the J,
J is much larger.
To be what?
Electron volt.
Well, this manganese local magnetic moment is 5 up.
Yes. I do not think there is any controversy whether manganese here is 5 half or not. Okay. If there is controversy, that controversy has not come to the surface. Everybody accepts it to be 5 half.
No, but the guy exchange is J square over EF.
No, that's correct.
So
that's
how much
J square over EF? Yeah, but that's just a few hundred Kelvin, right?
Yeah.
Because that's basically what you see. Right.
So how can you?
No, the question is that what is happening here? The question is not what is happening here. I'm kind of confused. What's the confusion here? I mean, question is not what is happening here, right here. Here in a mean field theory, everything should be saturated, right? All the spins should align unless you have some frustration or something else. Why shouldn't it align if you go to very low temperature?
Sure.
Right? I mean, it has nothing to do with energy scales or anything. If you go to very low enough temperature, they should order unless you have some reasons for them not to order. And I'll show you what the possible reasons could be for them not to order.
Some of them may be out of form against each other.
That's for example.
If it's random, there may be a pair.
Absolutely. Right. So you need something else which is not in this mean field type description for that to happen. So it could have disorder. It could be antiferromagnetic coupling and so on and so forth. That could be the missing thing. So the claim is this is saturated. This is the answer to your question. Okay, this is the claim.
If I just use that expression and put the J square over
right.
F and multiply by the
X
situation,
mm-hmm.
you get roughly a few hundred
kelvin. Yeah, and I do not call it theory. I call it taking one unknown TC, putting it in another unknown J.
Well, that's all right. Okay.
But J is not known. There is no single J describing this thing, right? I mean, where do you get J from? Yeah. So the claim is that if you take J to be something like 1.5 electron volt or something, which is not very unreasonable, then you do get TC to be of the order of 100. Well, let's ask the question reverse. Let's say TC is 100. What value of J do you need? The J that you need is not unreasonable. It's certainly within a factor of 2 or 3 correct. Okay? Now, let me just continue the story of annealing. This is even more recent results from the same group. And let's just get too many figures here. Let's just look at this one. Here they give you the transport data directly. So this answers the question you had. Here they're giving you the function of temperature directly, which is a better plot, okay? So here is this magnetization, and here is the resistivity corresponding to that. So they're giving you resistivity exactly at the same temperature, which is what they should do, and you can see what's going on. This also answers the question somebody else asked, Igor, you asked, how do they correlate? As you see that TP is always slightly larger than TC, slightly, not much. Okay, and here is the lower quality sample where, as you see, resistivity is much higher, and the peak is here, and it's a little bit higher always. Okay, so clearly there is correlation between transport properties and magnetism, but what it is we still need to. This is the most recent data of this nature, from Tom Foxon's group in Nottingham. This is a very very good group. He's one of the best MBA growers. Very recently started doing things in magnetic semiconductors. And here he's claiming that actually there is no reentrant metal insulator transition. And as he anneals things, he anneals at very low temperature. This other anneal that I showed you was not at such low temperature. He anneals right at 200 Kelvin where he's growing. And as you can see here, he claims the resistivity keeps on going down, down, down forever as he anneals. Look at the time scale. Okay. And he also claims, now unfortunately, they did not do a squid measurement. I do not know why, but they did not do a squid measurement. Maybe they don't have a squid. As you can see, that resistivity after annealing, great improvement. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. Semiconductor people normally would not have squids. Just as squid people would not have an MBE machine. So it's, you know, it's called division of labor. And the as you see, resistivity has gone down substantially. And this is this one, presumably. But they did extract magnetization information from this anomalous Hall effect. These are not very reliable things. They do anomalous Hall, and then they do adot plots. I don't want to go into the details of all these things, but if you know magnetism, then you know what I'm talking about. This is very, from transport of ferromagnetic materials, you can get magnetization information, okay? You have to have a model for the kind of scattering that is taking place, but you can. And when they do that, they claim that they have raised TC. This goes back to the question you are asking, to about 150 Kelvin. But unless they do it with a direct squid measurement, I don't know how believable it is. You know, this is indirect. But there is no question that some of the materials problems are solved. Yes? You're saying
so? I just agree with you. I don't think that this is...
No. We agree, of course. But I think this is an advance. I think we should give them that due. This is an advance. They have shown that resistivity keeps on going down as you anneal it more. And so Ono's claim that there is a reentrant metal insulator transition clearly is not quite correct. No, but this is high concentration. Oh, no, 6%. Yeah, reentrant is the high. Right. Low concentration, everybody agrees it's insulating. Right. Yes?
Is there any evidence that you aren't forming manganese clusters when you do the annealing?
I mean, there can never be evidence like that. I mean, you can always say there are manganese clusters as resolution lower than you can see. And there is no question there will be some. In this material now, okay. Let me then get back to the question. Let me ask a more general question. How does one know that this is a carrier-mediated ferromagnetism and not just ferromagnetism arising from manganese arsenide cluster? This is a million-dollar question. In fact, it turns out to be a $100 million question. That's what DARPA is putting into this subject. Manganese arsenide is a very good ferromagnet with TC of about 400 Kelvin. So how do you know that that's not happening here? Well, I mean, on a sense, one doesn't know. But there are lots of, I would say, circumstantial evidence to point out that's not happening. So you have to do experiments where you actually monitor carrier properties. One of those seminal experiments was done here, magnetic circular dichroism experiment. So you do an MCD experiment where you're directly looking at the carriers at the same time monitoring magnetization. And if you see they're correlating, then you can say, okay, there is, that's going on. Transport is another indication, okay? You can do various photoemission type experiments. All of those things have been done. The other more direct proof is that you obtain your magnetization from these transport properties by making some reasonable model for anomalous Hall effect. And you also directly measure magnetization using SQUID, which is what Ono did. And if they more or less coincide, you say it's coming from there. But you can never rule out manganese arsenide clustering. And I think some of these differences in results from different groups reflect that. On the other hand, there are other materials, like gallium manganese phosphide, where room temperature ferromagnetism is claimed, or cobalt titanium dioxide, where 1,000 Kelvin ferromagnetism is claimed. I personally believe that cluster formation is playing a very important role there. You know, this subject is like high TC was in 1988. But one thing I can absolutely guarantee you, in semiconductors, materials problems are solved much better than in other things. Because, and so it will be solved. These things will get sorted out. I have no doubt about it. Yes?
How can you see carriers by MCD?
You do not see carriers, but you see the spin split bands. You do not see the carriers. You see the bands.
Usually MCD gives you very local information, so you can check what's going on manganese.
I mean, the authors are not here, so they cannot defend themselves. It is not my work, so you can sit down and go through the paper. Maybe you will conclude that doesn't happen, okay? I just read the conclusion. I'm not an expert at MCD, and the conclusion sounded reasonable, but I don't want to get into that. It's David Ashram is just the next building. You can go tell him that your experiment doesn't mean anything.
Is it fair to say that as you anneal,
yes,
the magnetization simply goes away and the system becomes metallic?
But magnetization is not going away. Magnetization
reduced.
No, it's not reduced yet. In some experiments it reduced, some experiments it increased. That's what I'm saying.
Optimum.
Yeah.
But
no.
Can you correlate in the ones that it's increased, the resistivity goes up?
That's the claim these guys are making. That's exactly what this transparency I showed. Here, this one is higher magnetization, lower resistivity, not higher, lower. So it's more metallic. And this one, magnetization is lower, it's higher resistivity. So they are claiming that it correlates with more metallic it is, higher is TC.
Right.
Okay, that's the claim. But then that would not explain why in some other materials which are totally insulating, you see fairly high TC also. So you need to have theories which are on both sides of the metal insulator transition. Okay, it's tricky, and which basically tells you different things are going on. No single theory is going to explain all of it. Certainly not mean field theory.
Is it clear that this is an equilibrium phenomenon?
No, it's not clear at all. No, I mean, how can that be clear? Because this material is definitely very non-equilibrium material, because manganese doesn't want to go into gallium arsenide. But whatever it is, magnetization curves are of course equilibrium magnetization curves. It may not be equilibrium in the sense manganese ions may be moving around. You can see they're moving around. These annealing temperatures are very low. And some of the problems clearly arise from that. But this is material science. You know, this will get sorted out. This will get sorted out. Our job is to, you know, do the theory for various possibilities. Okay? So let me give you a list. This goes back to what Dan was saying, that this subject actually is an old subject. So in the 60s and 70s, europium oxide and europium sulfide were known. TC never went above 50 Kelvin or 60 Kelvin. Stephen von Molnar was one of the big players then. I talked to him and I asked him, exactly the question you asked. How come, people paid little attention to that and now this is a big subject? And he said, well, basically because they could never raise TC above 50 Kelvin, no hope of room temperature. Another problem later on I found out is that these are very bad materials to work with. They're not very stable materials and so on. In this material, the system was always insulating and there was no obvious local moments. I mean, nothing was put in from outside. It's just local moment is whatever you have there. But the phenomenology, that means some site of structure at transition temperature, all those things are very, very similar. Okay. Then in the 80s, there was a lot of work on 2,6 ferromagnetic materials. And some of them were found to be ferromagnetic, and the dopant was manganese. They were all insulating materials, and TC never went above 1 to 5 Kelvin. By the way, if you take the same mean field theory, this comes back to Chimia's question, and put the value of J that you expect here, you get a TC which is of the order of 10 Kelvin. So again, it's not inconsistent, for the value of TC. Then in 1992, again, Hide Ono found indium manganese arsenide to be ferromagnetic, but insulating, TC 10 Kelvin. Then gallium manganese arsenide, I already told you, it could be metallic or insulating, TC varies from 10 to 100 Kelvin. Then after this discovery, you know, the subject became, subject just exploded. So this was something like the Bednose and Muller for this field. Up to this point, only one or two individuals, really only one individual, just Hide Ono's group was working on it up to this point. After that, now, I think in the United States itself, I don't know, maybe 20 groups are working on it. For all I know, Santa Barbara itself has 5 groups working on it, probably. You see the number of materials now. Gallium manganese nitride, gallium manganese phosphide, gallium manganese antimonide, germanium manganese, gallium chromide nitride, gallium gadolinium nitride. And the main claim is make TC higher than TC, so at room temperature. So many of them, of course, found TC to be higher than room temperature. It's depressingly similar to the early days of high TC. And again, notice that whether it's metal or insulating, seems only to make a difference that for insulating materials in general, TC seems to be lower, but they are ferromagnets. Indium manganese gallium arsenide came on the market very recently. Then there are materials like this, cadmium manganese, germanium phosphide, antimony, vanadium, telluride. I think this actually exhausts the list. I think there is nothing else. I mean, I went to the literature very carefully. Yes?
You marked gallium manganese and antimonide as insulating. Is it kind of surprising?
No, it is actually metal. It's insulated or metal, both. Because originally, when I talked to them, they had only insulating. Now they have very nice metal, but their magnetization curve just looks like insulating material. Okay? So I should definitely correct that statement right now. Okay, so that's now, let's talk about these. And recently at Maryland, we have LSTO also, lanthanum strontium titanium oxide. That also has shown, yes, this is a preprint we posted 2 weeks ago. I'm doing experiments on this subject, by the way. I'm an experimentalist. I have 2 experimental papers on this. One is titanium cobalt oxide. One is cobalt dope lanthanum strontium titanium oxide. Now, it's not clear at all that these materials, the mechanism is the same. In this material, the mechanism may very well be nanocluster formation of cobalt. TC here is 1,000 Kelvin. And LSTO, we find TC to be 600 or 700 Kelvin.
Okay. What concentration of cobalt do you need?
Oh, very little. Very little, a few percent. Same like this manganese, same kind of number.
So
between 1 and 7%.
So it's basically a matrix of titanium oxide with a little bit of cobalt
in there. Right. This was first presented in 2002 in a science article from a group in Japan. And then we and the IBM group started following it up. And I was fairly convinced it's cobalt nanocluster. We found cobalt nanoclusters. Very hard to find nanoclusters, coming back to a question somebody asked. Very, very hard, because it's a really nano. But it's not clear that's the only ferromagnetism there. It seems there may be 2 transitions. One, high temperature transition into cobalt nanocluster, and then maybe lower temperature transition because of something intrinsic.
What is good temperature for bulk cobalt?
It's 1300. 1300, I believe. Yeah.
I mean, the strontium titanium oxide, what do you need to put in to get it to be?
Cobalt.
Also cobalt.
Also cobalt, yeah. It's a preprint posted in the last 2 weeks.
Okay. Is there a reason why you left out systems like the spinel CDCR2S4S?
I don't even know what they are. That's why I left them out.
Bulk for 90%.
Are they semiconductors? So what is the formula?
CDCR2SE4.
Okay, I know nothing about them. No one who works in this field, I mean, this conference has never mentioned it, okay? So the thing is that, you know, this is the culture of, I mean, I'm a theorist. I mean, if that's interesting, I'll look at it. But this is the first time I heard about them. And I can tell you that there are maybe 10 semiconductor spintronic conferences per year. And I cannot give you a guarantee none of them has ever mentioned them. But let's say if they're mentioned, presenter mentioned and nobody paid any attention. I do not know why.
No, if people don't know about it, that's good for me.
Yeah, I see. Are they interesting?
I think so. No, they show GMR for one thing, if you dope a little copper in.
Cadmium, mercury, chromium, selenide, spinel structure.
This probably belongs somewhere here, is my feeling, you know.
Yeah.
Here I'm sure I missed some things, okay? Here I have no doubt I have missed some things. I mean, if it's here, I take no responsibility. Here I'm sure I have missed some things, okay? I mean, the main interest really is in these materials, because these are standard semiconductor technology related materials.
Chromium and gadolinium concentration, the nitrides are also?
All of these, the concentrations are between 1 and 10%. Okay, I don't remember specific numbers here, so I don't want to make up a number for you. Okay. that's really the introduction, which is an hour, so the talk is over now. But I'm going to spend a few minutes telling you about some theoretical models. So this is the Hamiltonian we. So from now on, the talk will be mostly theory, but very simple theory. So this is the Hamiltonian we want to understand, if you really want to understand the full problem. So you have the Hamiltonian of the host semiconductor, which has to come from some kind of first principles calculation, or you have to model it. Then you have the coupling between the manganese spin and the carrier spin, which is, carrier spin is quantum mechanical on problem, manganese spin is classical. Then you have possible Coulomb interaction between the, on site, because you have doped it, okay? You have manganese ion sitting there. And there is no dynamics with that. It's just a local potential for the electrons or the holes. And the host material, of course, has the band structure part, okay, where we have subsumed the lattice potential into the band structure part here, and some static disorder, some randomness. So the real problem should take into account all of this. Let me tell you, almost all the work so far have concentrated on incorporating this as a small perturbation on that, leaving this out completely. That's one approach. That's what I call the valence band approach. This has been pioneered by Thomas Dittel in Poland and Alan MacDonald in Texas. Their viewpoint has been, this is a small perturbation of the band picture. So you're just going to do a perturbation calculation on the band. The main picture, the holes are in the valence band. All the action is in the valence band. All the action in the valence band. And the main thing to include is spin orbit coupling and those things in valence band physics.
So in your model, actually, there would be no magnetic ordering, no coupling, if there would be no doping, yeah?
That's correct.
All the magnetic.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And not intended, for instance, to explain the European oxide or
whatever. Not at all. These are only these new materials. Absolutely. Yes. This is what the word diluted magnetic semiconductors, the way in the semiconductor science, has come to mean that. You know how some word has some specific meaning? This has come to mean this thing. Okay. And in principle, I left something out here. There is an antiferromagnetic coupling between the manganese ions themselves, which I'll talk about later. So let me just tell you the two totally opposite, in fact, complementary approaches that have been taken. One is that the main physics all is here, and this is a small perturbation to that, and this is really negligible perturbation to that. This and this are negligible perturbations to that. So Thomas Dittel and Alan MacDonald have done very nice work trying to incorporate such a magnetic Hamiltonian into some model band structure calculation, you know, K dot P perturbation theory and things like that. And they have had some success along the line predicting TC and so on and so forth. Okay. Again, if you assume that J is known. I myself do not find that very satisfactory, because J really, you know, there is no single J modeling everything here. Valence band of gallium arsenide is very complicated. There are many bands, you know, coupled and so on. So to me, it looks more like, you know, subsuming one unknown TC into another unknown J. The other approach, which is the exact opposite approach, has been taken by Ravin Vaht, Louis Bray, more recently Elvio Dagoto. By the way, all the people who used to do CMR now are coming over here. As CMR is activity going down, you know, this is the... And what they do, they say the main physics is this randomness and this. This is not so important. We're just going to parametrize it by tight binding band, but you're going to do huge Monte Carlo simulation where you can incorporate disorder. Because the valence band approach basically leaves disorder out, leaves disorder out completely. Assumes a virtual crystal type thing. This, on the other hand, they do Monte Carlo, and their system is, of course, insulating. They're doing localized electron. Very nice approach, very huge calculations. But what I didn't realize until recently, when I actually read the papers to see how many electrons they have, they can have only three electrons. And three or four, that's it. It's not very satisfactory. They're doing quantum Monte Carlo. They're doing Fermion diagonalization, you know, on each side. It's very time consuming. Three or four, after four, no one can do anything. Okay. Elbio claims that he can do six, but he's doing some fudging, you know, some interpolation and so on and so forth. So I don't know. You're talking about long range order. You're talking about TC. You're doing finite size scaling to get TC. First, this Monte Carlo approach is limited to insulating systems. So so obviously, we have to develop theories. So let's develop some theories. Let's see, even on the simple mean field level, you know, mean field that was on 100 years ago, mean field that we teach our undergraduates, there are interesting aspects to this problem.
Yeah. Really non-interacting electrons, right? Non-interacting electrons, which you see some random potential due to the spins.
Yes.
That's what that water is doing.
Yes.
So why can they only do four electrons? In Anderson localization, people can do 100,000 sites.
No.
You have to average over that.
No, I don't think you are right.
Thermally populated.
Yeah.
Configurations.
The spin configuration changing, right?
No, but the Monte Carlo is done on the classical spins.
Yes.
In Darwin works. It's not quantum.
No. The fermions are completely quantum.
Yeah.
Yeah, the electrons are completely.
Right. They're not interacting. They're not interacting electrons in a random annealed potential.
So you have for each spin configuration, you have to calculate again the wave function.
You have to read
it. So that's
with spin disorder.
Well, I don't do this. So, I'm just quoting what they say in the paper. I mean, it must be extremely time consuming. It must be a memory versus speed thing. I do not know. I mean, what you're saying, I accept, but.
I don't know. Ravin gave a talk here and he didn't emphasize the
I have Ravin's paper. Look, I found this out very recently. Chandan Dasgupta asked me, how many electrons can they do? I said, I don't know. Must be hundreds. Okay, let's discuss this after this, okay? I mean, because I'll be interested in understanding why they cannot. I'm just telling you the facts, and I have the papers, I can show you the number, okay?
Here, this model where you have classical spins.
Right.
And then, okay, if you don't have localization, that seems like virtual. Like, suppose we have localization, and you think it's important, you suggest.
Yes, yes.
Now, this is at hundreds of Kelvin.
Yes.
And this doesn't take into account the elastic scattering at all, which is going to suppress what we're doing. So how do you view this?
No, let's come to that. I have not told you anything about the theories. I've just told you phenomenology of the subject, okay? I have not told you anything about my own work. Do you know how much self-control that takes? None! I'm talking about other people's work.
Well, you should not feel so much pressed by time.
People can leave. As long as you or one person is here, I can keep on talking. So let me just show you how, in a molecular field level, this problem is actually interesting and non-trivial. So you have this effective Hamiltonian, okay? Whole coupled to manganese. Now, so you have a two-field, you have two effective field, coupled two effective field molecular field approximation now. So the whole magnetization is a Brillouin function of the manganese magnetization, because the hole C is only manganese and manganese is only holes. That's the model, okay? So hole magnetization is a Brillouin function of manganese magnetization. On the other hand, manganese magnetization is a Brillouin function of hole magnetization. So you have this Brillouin function coming in. And in fact, when you do this, you immediately see that this would not look very mean field-like. The rest is pretty much standard. And let me just show you this theory in some, amazing, this has not been worked out. This is unpublished work. We're putting it in a long paper. Nobody has worked this out. And you'll already see magnetization plots start looking very much like what experiments see, just on this trivial thing. So the Hamiltonian is, and we actually threw in the antiferromagnetic coupling also, because at the mean field level, that can be handled. So you have an antiferromagnetic coupling between the manganese ions. You have the coupling between the holes and the manganese, which is local. And then you have some external field, and they have different G factors. Well, this is a problem we know how to solve. Weiss told us a long time ago. So we can now write the magnetization, the mean field magnetization, in terms of some effective field, the Brillouin function. And this effective field now will have three components. One is the external field. One is the field arising from manganese magnetization. One is the field arising from the whole magnetization. That is the whole mean field theory. Okay, and you'll have a similar equation for small m also, which I'll show you in the next line. So basic model now is that you have a bunch of manganese spins, and they see a few hole spins around, local coupling, so you have two kinds of couplings. We are ignoring hole-hole coupling here, but that is easy to put in at the LDA level. You just renormalize the G factor or something like that. So that's not difficult to do. So we have antiferromagnetic coupling between the manganese spins, and you have antiferromagnetic or ferromagnetic coupling between the hole and manganese. That doesn't really matter because square of that will come in, magnitude will come in. So this problem now clearly has two different possibilities. You can have localized holes, or you can have itinerant holes. These are all unpublished work, okay? So if the hole is localized, then it's just like the Weiss molecular field approximation. The only difference is the coordination number of corresponding to the holes is much smaller than coordination number corresponding to manganese, because the ratio is of the factor of 10, right? So for the localized holes, it goes back to what you are familiar with, except you have this Brillouin function coming in, and the fact that the coordination number, effective coordination number for holes is much less, comes in, and then you can just solve the problem and immediately find for this localized model, the coupling is linear in J, not quadratic in J. That's what you expect. Quadratic in J is a perturbative result. That's valid for small J. In small J, the holes are not localized, because in this model, localization is coming from having the spin potential. It's not coming from disorder or anything else. Okay? So then you find that it goes as proportional to J. This mean field actually smoothly interpolates between Ravin Vart's results and Alan MacDonald's result. Ravin Vart gets linear in J, Alan MacDonald's gets J square, and this mean field shows that's exactly what you should get. And then you can obtain TC also, just a simple formula. And it's now, if there is an antiferromagnetic coupling, it will go down, and so on and so forth. What happens on an itinerant? Why is it different for itinerant? Different for itinerant because magnetization for free electrons is not the magnetization for units. Pauli magnetism versus whoever else's magnetism the other one is, okay? So Pauli magnetism is different. It's hole up density minus hole down density. So you need to now use the density of state, fill it up to the Fermi level, and when you do that, that's the only thing you need. When you do that, you immediately find that the critical temperature now has this J square. This is the formula. This is the famous formula. I think this is already in Zener's paper in 1954, rediscovered recently in this context. And you get the susceptibility. This is the susceptibility coming in. This is the theory that I was talking about, because this is what goes by the name of mean field theory in this subject. But as I already said, you can have two kinds of mean field theory, either for extended system or for localized systems. And basically what it is, within this regime, if J is much, much less than T, then you'll use this one, because then it's a small perturbation. If J is much, much larger than T, then use that one. So what this says is that your TC will make a crossover from J squared to J behavior. And when you DMFT, you'll see that this physics is recovered. Yeah. This is what you expect, okay?
How justify this mean field for the local?
Actually, mean field is as justified as it is, you know, in the sense that you have to do it.
For extended calls, it's perfectly fine, but for localized calls.
Well, I mean, sure. So the thing is that there is no more justification here than it is in any other magnetic systems. It's a question of what it is that you're going to study. I would say that it's not very justified. But if you're just talking about trends and so on, it's something you have to do. Okay? I'm not going to go try to write a PRL on that result. Okay? But it's something you have to do to understand what is going on. Okay? Particularly since localized systems do show ferromagnetism also. Yeah.
You don't have disorder here, right?
No disorder. But we are putting in disorder now. We are doing this Bragg-Williams and Bethe-Pyrides approximation to this. And that actually can even enhance this in the localized system, because you can have clusters of manganese, you know, all those things.
There is a disorder because they are random.
This is a disorder at the trivial random level. What it means is that there are possible correlations now that one can put in, and that can be done. This mean field, this we learned in the 30s, right? Bragg-Williams and Bethe-Pyrides, all those things we are doing, and the results are actually pretty nice. They go in the direction, and we can say those are the effects of various annealing. I actually like this mean field theory, because in this problem, so little is known, and there are so many free parameters, that getting agreement with the experiment is neither necessary nor sufficient. You know, one needs to know what is doing what, and mean field theory is an analytic formula, so it's good.
How does MFT look like in your brilliant from brilliant?
That's connected. That's I'm dying to show you that. These are all unpublished results, okay? We have not even started writing the paper. So this is a lot of results, but I want to spend a few minutes on it. Localized hole model. Immediately starts seeing things to be very depressed. This is a generic feature of disordered ferromagnets. You go to magnetic glasses. I bought these two books on magnetic glasses recently. Basic result, if you read the books, they'll first tell you that the magnetization is always suppressed from the standard Billmann function picture, like this. And you see that's what is happening in a very big way here. Magnetization is suppressed. This ratio is the ratio of the hole density to manganese density. Here, you have the similar effect is much less. Okay, here I'm saying much less. So this is for, and this is for the holes themselves, magnetization for the holes themselves. This is magnetization for the manganese, this is magnetization for the hole. Magnetization for the hole does not matter for overall magnetization, because that's like 1 or 2%, right? Because you have factor of 10 lower holes and a factor of 5 lower magnetization, so 5 times 10 is 50. But what you find is that this is less affected than that, very strongly affected. Nature, this looks very screwy. Well, we can do the same thing for that, putting in antiferromagnetic coupling, and as you'd expect when you put in antiferromagnetic coupling, TC goes down. And let me not discuss this. And the effect is much, much stronger, much, much stronger on the extended system than on the localized system. The effect of having antiferromagnetic. This is also consistent with the experiment, actually, in the sense that it looks like these manganese interstitial defects affect the metallic situation much more than insulating situation. But this is a technicality. I don't want to discuss it too much on this detail. You say, what you should immediately say, but you did not show me any transparency where magnetization looks like that.
So this is direct local moment?
Direct local moment, yes.
And
yeah.
Fashion?
Yeah, this is the theory I just showed you. That theory can have JAF. You see, the theory that I showed you here, this Hamiltonian, we kept, what is the Hamiltonian? We kept, because at mean field level, you know how to do these things. Okay, so we kept this. There's no reason not to keep this.
And how to vary the localization in this Hamiltonian? Which parameter were you varying?
There's no localization here. Okay, just the coordination number. Okay. So as somebody said, it's, you know, that the magnetic, this is just totally disordered. So you just assume that is the average number is what they see. So it's subsumed to the coordination number. That's the, you know, Weiss mean filter is great in that sense, right? I mean, it's, but we are doing it, as I said, you know, you can improve. I mean, in your review article, you guys actually say that, that Bragg Williams, you know, there is a sentence in your review article. It's absolutely correct. Only reason I knew about Bragg Williams is I taught statistical mechanics. I mean, there's no other way I would have known that. I don't know how you guys knew about it. But it's indeed correct that it can be improved upon that. So you should not say, well, but you did not show me anything that looks like this. You did show us, look, this looks very much like what I was showing you before. You don't believe it? Well, you probably do believe it, but I want to show you how much it looks like that. See this, oh, too many. If you look at this behavior, this one, this certainly looks somewhat like this, you know, one kink here. But I have not shown you anything that looks like this. So you should say, well, I mean, you have not shown us anything like that, so where is that coming from? That would be the next transparency, because I did not show you the magnetization for the localized system. This is germanium manganese. I showed you the transport properties of germanium manganese, and I told you that's a localized system, insulating system. Look at how M of T looks there, concave. This is a generic feature of these dilated magnetic semiconductor systems. The metallic systems show convex outward magnetization, but not mean field-like, somewhat suppressed. And the insulating systems show concave outward magnetization, always, okay, like this. And this was already seen by Ravin Vaht in his numerical work, in this Monte Carlo simulation that we are discussing. He did not make any comment on that. He just said this is what it's found, okay? And what we are showing, that if you do a mean field theory, this is what you expect, okay? Now, this work is very new.
When did he start relying on the percolation of these magnetization clusters?
Well, that's, he just did a numerical work, okay? There is no theory, and since I can read mind, particularly your mind, that's the next topic, okay, polar on percolation. So Alexey Kaminsky at Maryland came up with a very simple theory of how to think about magnetization in this localized limit. It's a complete analytic theory, okay? It turns out that this theory, quote-unquote, can be verified by Elbio Dagoto and Ravin Vaht's numerical work. Ravin's numerical work was already done before. Elbio specifically did and found very good agreement with what you're predicting, even with the formula, okay? Now, this theory basically is motivated by the fact that both metallic and insulating systems are showing ferromagnetism in this system. So you need something which is valid in the insulating regime also. An insulating regime, this concept of bound magnetic polaron goes many, many years back. And the basic idea is that the carrier is not free. It's bound at an impurity site. And this binding in the specific calculation I'll show you cannot be due to Anderson localization, just because the way we did the theory. But in general, it can be Anderson localization. So you have some localization length, which is Bohr radius here. It's more like regular binding. And then we have magnetic impurities. So this is the Hamiltonian we want to solve, okay? Where the electron wave function is this, and the manganese, there is no dynamics. And very important point, for each hole, the red is hole here, there are many manganese ions. So the small green ones is the big. So green is green, red is red. Because that's, as you lower temperature, what would happen? Well, as you lower temperature, they will want to, now entropy cost is lower. So they will order locally to lower free energy. And so if you manganese around this hole, the hole is localized, you'll order. And this polaron radius, this is called a bound magnetic polaron, just one local object, you can very easily calculate. And you get this formula, you can see, since that is exponential. But this is not enough. Yeah?
You really mean Bohr radius here?
I do not mean Bohr radius. I mean some localization length for, you know, is the length over which the carrier is localized. Okay? So in this calculation, we specifically thought it's binding, like impurity binding, shallow impurity binding in semiconductor.
So it should have.
Yeah, but that number for this particular case is more like 7 angstrom.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a small. That depends. That number will come in the end when you want numbers. This is a theoretical construct. Okay?
Why is logarithmic? Is this possible to understand?
Yeah, logarithmic, of course, because this is exponential. Because this wave function exponential is as simple as that. Okay.
But key is temperature or what?
Yeah, yeah. So you have to calculate free energy and minimize it, and because that's exponential. But there is a non-trivial part. That's not the whole story. Now what you want to do is, so this is our one of the magnetic polarons, okay? This is a magnetic polaron. They will be at any particular temperature, they'll be randomly oriented. So it's like a large system composed of little tiny magnets. Each of these blobs, think of them as a tiny magnet, you know, a few angstrom or 10 angstrom in size, and you have thrown them randomly on a substrate, okay? This is a completely different way of thinking of magnetization, on which a lot of work has been done, mostly in the Soviet, you know, like Boris Shklovsky's book has a whole chapter on it, if you look at it. So you have a matrix in which you have thrown a whole bunch of little tiny magnets, which you're calling bound magnetic polaron randomly. And the question we're asking, when will there be global ferromagnetism? So the answer to that question is, when you have a cluster spanning the whole system. The moment a cluster spans the whole system, that's called the particulation transition, and you have a ferromagnet. But when does that happen? We have just the picture for one. To do that, you have to do some technical work. I'm going to really skip the technical work. I don't want to give a two-hour talk. You have to really solve the problem of two polarons. You have to look at our PRL. We had a PRL earlier this year, Kaminsky and I. And of course, it's on CONMAT. Everything is on CONMAT. You have to solve the problem of two polarons. Once you do that, you can then just borrow results from spherical percolation theory. This is the problem in percolation. These little tiny balls, think of them as spheres. It doesn't matter. In reality, they may not be spheres. So you're throwing these spheres. They're overlapping. And you're asking the question, when do you have a percolation transition here? This is a problem of overlapping percolation, overlapping spheres. This is a problem on which a lot of numerical work has been done. One knows where the percolation transition takes place. It takes place when, so there is only one parameter in the problem, size of the sphere and their density. So dimensionless parameter is r cube root of n, and the percolation transition takes place on r cube root of n is 0.86. This is all we need to develop a full theory for this problem. This we borrowed from percolation numerical work, and let me just show you the result. Everything is a function of that one scaling variable. We can calculate TC. Alexey Kaminsky did a very nice calculation of TC. TC depends on, as I said, TC depends on J0. It doesn't depend on J squared, it depends on J, okay? Because a strong coupling limit. And its density dependence is different from mean field. But amazingly, if we go to the mean field limit, this agrees actually with mean field. It's an amazing thing. If you go to the mean field limit, it agrees the mean field. And where does this theory apply? With a strongly localized regime. We are assuming that, you know, things are all localized. It applies where this AB cubed times NH is much, much less than 1, which is very low density, low hole density. And it also must satisfy another condition, that AB cubed NH is also much, much less than AB cubed NI times cube. That also comes into the theory. Again, it's a technical point. I don't have time to get into it. It turns out if you put manganese arsenide AB, which is like 7 angstrom or something like that, then this theory is valid almost all the way to NH almost equal to NI, so maybe in the whole regime. Only thing is that if your system is showing metallic transport, then it's not clear you should apply this theory, but I'm not convinced that a single system in this problem is metallic. Why am I saying that? And recently Paul Crowell told me that I may be right. If you look at this resistivity, if you look at any of the resistivity I show you, if you look at the lowest temperature where they're not showing data anymore, it's clear it's going back up. I'll bet you that all these systems are actually insulating at zero temperature. They're impurity band. So, you know, so that at finite temperature, you have a lot of carriers, but I'll bet you at T is equal to zero, they're all insulators.
But if I may say the following.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that the fact that it's convex and not concave and so forth, it just simply reflects the fact that there's a log scale, log T scale. Plotted everything on log t scale, then it
looked
like a Brillouin function. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, that may very well be right, but I do not understand the point. Well, point I make. Experimentally, they see that is the point.
I mean, from this percolation theory, is the size of the polaron just given proportional to log t?
No. If it's not that trivial, if it is that trivial, we would not get a PRL. Believe me, it's much less trivial than that. You have to read the paper, okay? It's much, much less trivial than that. Well, since you asked. It's not that trivial. It involves some work. You really have to solve that two-polaron problem. You really have to think, because it's not a formalism. You really have to solve the problem of two polarons interacting with each other. To figure out the number of impurities in lens region, and this is the quote-unquote trivial part that you're talking about, but there is another term. This is new. No one in the magnetic percolation.
I didn't mean that to say this trivial. Just want to say what the log enters in an important way. And the log tells us that
Hold on. It's not just, that's absolutely correct. But there is a function log here, there's a function log here.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the fact
you are right.
Absolutely. This is a very important statement because you have a very flat resistivity as a function of temperature. The problem is that this is not so.
Absolutely. So we would not apply this theory in the metallic regime, as I just said. Does this theory, when you look at its starting point, as I said, starting point is exponentially localized electron wave function. So you should have resistivity rising very fast at some low temperature. And experimentally, if this is happening below 1 Kelvin, maybe it's not, doesn't apply to, and I agree, absolutely. And because that's true, let me show you the result if we, so this is our theory, okay? This is the magnetization as a function of theory. Magnetization is the only thing people measure, you know, direct measurement as a function of TC. It looks very much like experiment. If you forgot the experiment, it's right here. Okay, here is the experiment. As you see, it looks very similar. Looks very similar to numerical work also. But we can now take the theory and apply it just blindly for high values of density. Well, the theory doesn't really apply. I completely agree with you. But often, if you have a theory which is basically correct, we know it's, you know, its radius of convergence sometimes. It works outside its radius of convergence often. Here, notice what happens. If we just take this, the theory is really valid when AB cube NH is much, much less than 1. So it's really valid here. But if you just apply it blindly, it actually gives magnetization which is pretty reasonable. This, of course, happens in many, many theories in physics. So you see, what you are saying, that is log. This part also, the thing is log. But look, it's not concave. So what you are saying is because there are other terms here. You see what I'm saying?
It's the first statement to say that you get a log because of the exponential tensor.
So right.
The bulks are like
sufficient. Exactly. Exactly. Then you have... You know, so what we are trying to do now is to develop a transport theory also based on these ideas. Yeah. Power correlation actually is a very powerful thing in magnetization, understanding magnetization. In any case, we can then go on and get all the critical indices and so on, but this is boring. I mean, this will never be measured. Let me just take, you know, Antoine and Gabi are waiting very patiently. Let me just tell you the theory that we are most proud of in this subject, which is the first paper we published, which is that We took their word literally and just used dynamical mean field theory as a toolkit to this problem, because we said this problem is ideally suited to dynamical mean field theory. It has all the elements of dynamical mean field theory that long review article by the four stalwarts tell us, and I just quoted a few sentences from their thing, just told them, I think, straight out. No, I did not put inverted quotes. I'm sure I did not steal them, change a few words, okay? So mean field theory is a lattice problem, but those of you who do not know about dynamical mean field theory, maybe that's impossible here. You must have had lots of talks. Mean field theory is a lattice problem with many degrees of freedom replaced by a single site problem in an effective medium. This is the Weiss mean field theory, right? It's exact when dimensionality goes to infinity. Now, we now know that dynamical mean field theory, which is also an uncontrolled theory, like mean field theory, that means if it doesn't work, improving it is not easy. But dynamical mean field theory is a similar thing for quantum problems. You replace a lattice model with many quantum degrees of freedom by a single site quantum impurity problem. Okay, so it's kind of a quantum version of the mean field theory, where it's not Hartree-Fock. Hartree-Fock is a mean field theory also. Here, the dynamical fluctuations, temporal fluctuations, are treated correctly. Okay, but spatial fluctuations are being thrown out. So this, we were already doing CMR. In fact, Andy Millis has been collaborating with me for a long time, and he was doing CMR. And then I kind of pointed out that we should really not worry about CMR much more and apply this theory to these systems. And the same Hamiltonian, and we can work with this Hamiltonian, there is no problem. In fact, we can put antiferromagnetic coupling. We can put this W. We have put this W now. We have put antiferromagnetic coupling. Now we are putting the random potential using a paper of Vladimir and Gabi going back 97, I guess, this paper, on a Bethe lattice, trying to understand localization here. All those things can be done here. It's a lot of work, but it can be done. Don't have to, so the motivation, maybe this audience doesn't need motivation, is that this is a function of many, many, many parameters, right? J, bands, Fermi energy, X, N, M, J antiferromagnetic, compensation. Many, I mean, it really is a function of many. You can see that when you look at the results, experimental results, okay? So the main thing we'll do is just to see how much free energy changes when you put some, you know, for small j. I mean, you know, even this thing people are arguing. Are the carriers in valence band or are they in the impurity band? And there are all kinds of questions. How good? So if I take the band structure calculation of Nicola Hill here, then it seems that, you know, these are the two regimes that are kind of understood. J much, much larger than T is the double exchange regime, and J less than T is the part arbitrative regime. This system seems to be closer to this regime. J comparable to T and XJ comparable to EF. And in this regime, none of these theories, mean field or double exchange models, really work. So we thought that we are just going to use DMFT to see what's going on. I'm not going to spend much on DMFT. Just one crucial point for technical experts. There is just one issue here. How do you incorporate X, the manganese? And the way they incorporate is this. So all of you know these equations. So you have this Green's function. In Green's function, you have two different probabilities. One is the probability of having magnetic sites. That goes with X. And probability of having a non-magnetic site, that goes as 1 minus X. In reality, of course, you should do something much better. But this turns out to be pretty good as a zero order theory. By the way, this was not trivial. We had many possibilities, and what we did originally, we did not publish, because Andy had an idea originally, he and I had disagreement. And eventually we did both thing. I will not even tell you what how he wanted to do it. I always had the feeling that this is the correct approximation, and I think this is the correct approximation. And then you turn the machinery, which was done extremely efficiently, like in a day or two, by Yu-Hien Huang and Amit Chattopadhyay, and I'm just going to show you results. You know what we can incorporate here? We can incorporate band structure. So this is how the impurity band is forming. This physics is not in the mean field theory. So this is the nominal, let's say, valence band edge. Okay, for the experts, we just do a Bethe lattice. So our density of states is semicircular, but close to the edge, it's like a regular parabolic band, so it's good. Okay? And so when you increase J, what happens eventually is that you have spin split impurity band. Look at it, by that time J is 2, okay? Impurity band has totally split out. You have spin up and spin down impurity band. This physics can be incorporated in DMFT, but not in the mean field theory that you're talking about. And there are recent experiments from where I think the Santa Barbara people supplied the samples. And the experiment was done by Basov, Dmitry Basov in San Diego, where this PRL came out in August. I was just reading the PRL in the flight. I didn't look at it before. They conclude that this impurity band picture applies to gallium manganese arsenide. This was their conclusion. They end the paper by saying that it's clear that for their data is consistent with our data results, and it applies. Impurity band picture is consistent. This is infrared in conductivity analysis of the kind Basov has earlier done in HiTC and CMR, and he just concludes that. Let me not spend, it will take 10 minutes to go through this thing if you don't know, you know. And if you know, then I don't need to spend any time, okay? Yeah. You must have seen lots of figures like this in this thing, right? No? Yeah. If you had a question, ask, but it's very standard stuff. I mean,
yeah. It seems like this is probably something like when you have X, when you have those sides,
right,
which has the spin,
yes,
then it shifts the chemical potential.
Right. Right, you can think of it that if you want. Yeah, absolutely. There is a coupling there. Coupling. Yeah, there's coupling there, right. It's the spin version of Falikov-Kimball, absolutely. Yeah. Now we can calculate everything. We can calculate the phase diagram, and we're doing all those things. But our first PRL, which came out last year in 2001, exactly about a year ago, we show how TC will behave in this model. And I'm just going to end in 5 minutes now. How TC will behave. Remember, there are too many variables in this problem, right? Let me remind you the variables. The important variable for our purpose are X and N. We are using T as the dimension quantity. So everything in dimensionless unit as a function of TC over T. So bandwidth, exchange coupling between the holes and manganese. We ignore in this calculation antiferromagnetic coupling. We have other unpublished calculation already of antiferromagnetic coupling. I'm going to show you too many variables. It's impossible to take any image home. Fixed value of X, optimum value. How do things behave as a function of N? Here, depends on your value of G of T. If J over T is very large, and this may not be unrealistic. I mean, Nikolai is sitting there. It may not be unrealistic for gallium manganese arsenide. Perhaps this is more realistic, but this may not be unrealistic. Then at first it will go up and then it will come down. So over here, for very small j, this theory reproduces mean field result, as it should. It goes up as j squared. But it quickly deviates from mean field, and eventually if you increase j, it will come down. And the reason is there'll be some other phase. It's not going to be a ferromagnetic phase. I mean, this is what. But if you have very small coupling, then it will go up and saturate, and it will come down at very, very high density somewhere. And in fact, this is one of the reasons. If you now apply the same theory to LSTO, Gabby, you're asking me about LSTO. If you apply the same theory for LSTO, it should check TC should be zero. Okay, you have a question?
No. Why does it come down? I missed that point. Can you say that?
Where?
Why does it come down?
Well, that's from the impurity band, right? I mean, if you look at the impurity bands, right, for large J, we have well-defined. Now, if you fill the impurity band, right, if you fill the impurity band, it's very, very simple reason. It's impurity band physics. I mean, when we saw it and we saw the impurity band pictures, we're very happy because the physics is very simple.
No.
No. And for low density, now coming back to LSTO, the reason both Andy and I are surprised that we do not think it can be this mechanism, LSTO, if you put in some reasonable numbers, Andy found some band structure parameters from somewhere. I don't know how believable they are, you know, we need that T. Then we find that TC should definitely be zero in LSTO because the density is very high in this LSTO material. Do you understand what I'm saying? This cobalt dope LSTO, suppose we just put in, here is our TC, right? Suppose we put in the parameters corresponding to cobalt dope LSTO to the extent they are known. How believable they are, I do not know. And Andy claims that he found them. Then our theory should say TC should be zero according to this mechanism. So there must be some other mechanism. That's what I said when I said that, well, we do not know if it's carrier mediated or not. That could be nanocluster or something else. Okay?
When you're talking about the LSTO, which comes from presence of strontium, are you talking about?
Strontium, like, I believe it's around half, you know, in the strong correlation regime. Strong correlation regime.
Equal concentration.
Right. Right. It's around. No, but yeah, it's this ferromagnetism we see for rather large values of X, but I think optimum, this 700 Kelvin or something was around. Yeah, it is a metal. Yeah. It is a metal at that value of X. Yeah. So is many of these things. Right. Anyway, then you can ask about how things vary as a function of J. This is the same physics here, just plotting it differently. It comes down for large J. If the density is low, it comes down very fast and so on and so forth. All of this can be understood on this impurity band picture that I showed you. And we have done, let me show you, the final thing I'll show you, then I'll really stop, is I have more results. I have optics, I have transport, but it's clear I don't want to give three talks. This is the magnetization calculated on DMFT theory. And you notice that we are getting results very similar. This is all unpublished. Half of the results I'm showing here are unpublished. So you see that for low carrier, and we use carrier density as a parameter. As the carrier density goes down, it's looking very much like. So experimentally, they tell us that this variation due to annealing is coming entirely from carrier density. That's what they tell us. If you take that as a fact, then we can reproduce experimental magnetization plot more or less very well on the basis of this DMFT theory. Okay? But this is really, you know, pushing the theory too far. We are just saying there's only one parameter. That's what the experimentalists say, but that's kind of hard to believe. There is just one parameter that is controlling everything, and that one parameter is carrier density. Well, if that is the case, we do get something very similar. I think that may be we have done things as a function of magnetic field. That looks very much like the experimental result also, and so on. I'm not going to show you optics because it's just going to take too long. I mean, it really is going to take too long. So let me just stop here. I mean, I'm going to be here today and tomorrow. Anybody interested, I'll be happy to discuss. Let me just show you my collaborators and so on, because that's very important. Of course, this is very active research area. A lot of people are working on it. Directly, I'm interacting with Andy Millis, less so now than I did 2 years ago, who I think currently is in Colombia, but who knows where he'll be next year. He moves around. Amit Chattopadhyay, who was at Maryland, has moved to IBM a couple of years ago. And then Alexia and Yuhian Huang are still Maryland. And this cobalt that I mentioned, I didn't show any result, cobalt titanium dioxide, cobalt LSTO, this is really done by Shoti Shogale, who is a senior research scientist you have at Maryland. The person who really runs Vinky Venkatesan's Pulse deposition group, a very large group. My role here is that they were only doing CMR. They were wasting their time on CMR. So I went and told them, I said, just stop CMR and do oxides, that, you know, titanium oxide, LSTO. That was really my role here, but they got very nice results. And then, of course, you know, DMS in general, I have discussed a great deal with Hideo Ono, who is the pioneer of this subject. And then I discuss a lot with these people, Nicola, who is here. We are talking about collaboration. What we want to do is something ambitious. And if somebody would give us some money, we may even be able to do it someday, which is combining first principle band structure with DMFT for this problem. And it can in principle be done. We just need a joint postdoc who will actually do it. We have not succeeded in getting money yet, but maybe we'll get some money. And then my main competitors are Thomas Dittel and Alan McDonald, two different groups, who believe that the physics of DMS is more or less well understood. It's mean field theory of valence band holes. That is their picture. And they believe that as long as you put details on it, spin orbit coupling and whatnot, everything follows. I disagree with them, but I think it's a healthy disagreement. I mean, because I disagree with them for purely stupid reasons. I disagree with them because then the subject doesn't need theorists. That's the reason I disagree with them. That if it's just something that was done 100 years ago, you know, then what are you doing? I'm going to stop here. I thank all of you. I'm very touched that so many of you stayed 35 minutes over time. So I thank you, okay? And I'll be here all day today, all day tomorrow, and I may even come in on Saturday. I'll be delighted to talk to all of you. Yes.